Tagore and Einstein, both seers of the modern era. Apparently, you know who Einstein is. Tagore was a great poet, philosopher from India who won the Nobel Prize in 1928. And Tagore and Einstein met on the outskirts of Berlin in 1930. And we have a very interesting conversation between the two of them. Einstein says there are two different conceptions about the nature of the universe. Number one, the world as a unity dependent upon humanity. And number two, the world as a reality independent of the human factor. To which Tagore responds, when the universe is in harmony with man the eternal, he doesn't call it the universe eternal, he says man the eternal, when the universe is in harmony with man the eternal, we know it as truth, but we feel it as beauty. We know it as truth, we feel it as beauty. To which Einstein says, this is a purely human conception of the universe. And Tagore says, there can be no other conception. This world is a human world. The scientific view of it is also that of the scientific human being. To which Einstein then says, now I know why I am more religious than you are. So another beautiful quote from Tagore that summarizes this morning's talk. The same stream of life that runs through my veins runs through the world and dances in rhythmic measure. It is the same life that shoots in joy through the dust of the earth into numberless blades of grass and breaks into tumultuous waves of leaves and flowers. It is the same life that is rocked in the ocean cradle of birth and death, in ebb and in flow. I feel my limbs are made glorious by the touch of this world of life, and my pride is from the life throb of ages, dancing in my blood this moment. That experience, that expression can only come from a higher state of consciousness. It can only come from unity. It can only come if we have experienced this transcendent, that silence within us, which is beyond perceptual changes. I tell my patients who are taking chemotherapy, I say, ask your oncologist. Sit down with him and ask him every single question that you have. And if he's not able to satisfy you, go see another one, or I'll send you to another one. He should be able to answer every single question that you have. And many times, when you do that, and I in fact sit down with my patients and call up the oncologist together, we have a conference call, if he's not prepared to do that, then I don't want him as your doctor, as always my doctor. I want somebody who can rationally explain to me every move that he makes. And I don't want to relinquish the control of this thing to an oncologist or anybody. Many studies show now that patients, and these are done in breast cancer patients, by the way, that breast cancer patients who relinquish the control of their disease to an outside agency, including a medical deity, an MD, then then they don't do as well as the ones who keep the control to themselves. And therefore, you should be in control, and you should be making the decisions using your oncologist to give you information. That's very crucial, very, very crucial. And it may be that the decisions are right, but you have to know that. So many times I talk to oncologists who've made a certain decision. And when you start probing and start questioning them, you find that there was no logic to that decision. In which case, that treatment obviously should be abandoned. But if there is a logic, and there is many times, and you know there's a wide variety of spectrum in all cancers, including breast cancers, and if an oncologist has made that decision very clearly, and rationally, and one should go with it. I just saw a patient last week, and he had a melanoma in his genitalia. They excised the melanoma, but then they wanted to do a radical dissection of the lymph nodes in his inguinal region. Now, for one who knows that procedure, that ultimately leads to elephantiasis of the leg, becomes big and swollen like this. So he didn't want to do it. So I said, let's find out. You know, I don't know that much about it. It's an unusual location for melanoma. Let's go look at the books. All the books say that you should do this. All the textbooks of medicine say that you should do this. But they don't say why. So we said, well, let's call up the guy who wrote the textbook. So we did. We called up the fellow who's written the textbook on the disease. And we started questioning him. And then finally he admitted, he said, there's no logic to this, we just do it hoping it works. So I said, if you had it, would you have it done? There was silence on the other side. Ultimately, he said, no, I probably wouldn't. So this patient is now convinced that he shouldn't do it, and I am convinced that he shouldn't do it. I think it's time to start questioning every move, and that is what is causing this change in the medical profession. It is demanded of them, and it will change them. It's happening. Okay. Yes? What is my opinion of AZT again? Yeah. The question is, what is my opinion of AZT? I may give an opinion which may not be the most valid opinion, but I'll give it to you anyway. My opinion is that it does alter the expression of the disease for about 12 months or so. But after that, it doesn't seem to make any difference. In fact, some studies in Europe show that after 13, 14 months, it may actually work the other way. Dr. Pert, by the way, whom I mentioned frequently this morning, has discovered that the body makes certain peptides that can block the receptors to the entry of the virus in the cells. And she's working on this and isolating this factor. I think that's a very exciting development. But that's all I can say about AZT. I know of several patients, by the way. Again, from the Ayurvedic perspective, the virus isn't the cause of the disease. The virus is just a precipitating agent in a susceptible host, because many people have the virus and don't have the disease. Many people have the virus and don't have the expression of the disease. I met a person recently from another country in his 40s who holds or has the world record for swimming the 100 meters dash for his age. And about 2 weeks ago, he decided to have a blood test because he found out that some former friend of his had AIDS. And he decided to have a blood test and he found out that he had it. And he's completely devastated. Till 2 weeks ago, this man could hold the world record for swimming. And now he's tired in the afternoon, he's having all these coughing spells, etc. We had to spend 2 days telling him that, you know, he was going to die of the diagnosis rather than of the disease. So once you understand the mechanism, you know, and now we have two clinics, you know, one particularly very successfully operating in San Francisco, where patients have a different experience of this disease. completely different experience of the disease. When I go to San Francisco, they say, come, please go and talk to my doctor. He's getting all stressed out because he doesn't believe what he's seen. You know? The question is, what recommendation would you have for somebody who's completely asymptomatic? Doesn't have any symptoms, just has a positive test. I would say, have a good time, enjoy life. Focus on health, the experience of health. Do you feel that psychotherapy is, which in fact puts you in touch with your stress, is helpful or harmful? Now we have a very basic, simple expression in Ayurveda. What you put your attention on becomes stronger in your experience. So psychotherapy, again at the cost of annoying a lot of psychotherapists, I would say that the so-called analytical psychotherapy can in fact create more problems. We don't analyze the problem, we just shift our attention from them to other things which are there. So, or we transcend the problem itself. So, that is our view. Yes?
I am an analytic psychotherapist, but nevertheless, mobilizing that, then as a byproduct, has to deal with the underlying problem.
So, this lady is an analytical psychotherapist, and she says that what she does is, rather than focusing on the problems, she mobilizes the underlying solutions. And as a side effect, that the underlying problems seem to dissipate. And that, of course, is then a wonderful thing to do. Yes? The question here is that should one completely go in one direction or another, or can one combine the two approaches? I think, have I restated it accurately? Not necessarily. I think in each individual patient is a unique circumstance. And one should take that uniqueness into part of the evaluative process. And many times the two approaches can be complementary. But we do know of people who have made up their mind to completely go the unconventional route and in fact have done extraordinarily well. There's a recent report, by the way, of a patient from England who has the re-emergence, to my knowledge, this is the first time that I have encountered it, it's the re-emergence of P24 antibody. They do different kinds of tests in England. P24 antibody disappears when you have AIDS. And to my knowledge, it has never been documented that it can actually come back, which means that the whole immune picture has changed. And there's one case report about that. And I think now that there's one case report, you'll start seeing more, because consciousness is a field. Yes. The question is that lady is fascinated with the idea that all the cells are thinking cells, and she wants to know what do they do when they think. Well, that's the process of creation. That's how they manifest themselves. Our memories manifest themselves as our bodies. Our bodies are the place that memory calls home. Our body is just the place that memory calls home. Your skin cells change once a month, but they don't forget the difference between hot and cold. Your taste buds change every 6 weeks, but they don't forget the difference between sweet, sour, and salt. So, in fact, we don't have to think of any esoteric reincarnation theory here, but the fact is that our memories or the information fields are constantly incarnating themselves as the physical body, as an ongoing process. If you change the memories, We change the physical expression of the body also. We can't change it by making a mood of it. That's why I have a little problem with all this positive thinking idea. Because we can do it, but after a while it becomes a strain. No, after a while it becomes a strain. If you're not feeling like that, then it's going to be a strain. More important than the ability to think is the ability not to think. We are not human beings, not human doings, we are human beings. So when we stop doing and just are, then in the gap between thoughts is what is the field of infinite possibilities. And each field is a, you know, say, Maharshi gave this example also a few weeks ago. He says, when I say, I am going, then between the I and the am, that gap, infinite possibilities. That becomes then one possibility through the in value of intention. Let's say I said, I am not going. Okay? Then, the gap between am and not is a field of infinite possibilities. And the gap between not and going is also a field of infinite possibilities. But these two gaps, being infinite, being both fields of infinite possibilities, still are different fields because of the value of attention and intention. So in that gap, when you have the intention, then you create. Yes? How does this new paradigm affect people with problems? That's the question. Whether the problems are financial, socio-economic, problems of pollution, etc., etc. And the answer is in two ways. First, if you want to change the world, from the Vedic perspective, we say, that's a great noble intention, but first change yourself, because you are the world. So first take care of yourself, and then the world will also change. And when enough people change, then ecological problems, social problems, inequality, etc., these are all expressions of global mind right now. And as the paradigm shift takes place, then automatically more responsibility, more concern for each other. Let me read to you something that I picked up the other day from something in one of the old texts. Again, this is a conversation. This is how most of the Vedic texts are, in the form of conversation. So the two are talking, and it's obvious that one person is enlightened, the other is still on his way. So, he says, how shall I recognize the state when I reach it? And the answer is, there will be no fear. So, again, the questioner says, surrounded by a world full of mysteries and dangers, how can I remain unafraid? And the answer, your own little body is full of mysteries and dangers, yet you are not afraid of it, for you take it as your own. What you do not know is that the entire universe is your body, and you need not be afraid of it. You may say you have two bodies, the personal and the universal. The personal comes and goes, the universal is always with you. This entire creation is your universal body. You are so blinded by what is personal that you do not see the universal. This blindness will not end by itself. It must be done, undone, skillfully. And then, again, later on in the same conversation, he says, the questioner says, how can it be? I'm only a part of the world. How can the whole world be contained in the part except by reflection, mirror-like? And the answer is, your personal body is a part in which the whole is wonderfully reflected, but you have also a universal body. You cannot even say that you do not know it because you see and experience it all the time. Only you call it the world and are afraid of it. It's a perceptual shift. And when that perceptual shift takes place, then the psychology changes. And everybody changes. I mean, why do you think Mr. Gorbachev made a very fantastic statement to Mr. Reagan a couple of years ago? He said, we are going to do something really terrible to you Americans. We're going to deprive you of an enemy. I mean, that was a remarkable statement. That's a paradigm shift. What do you do when you lose your enemy? So social responsibility and, you know, social change comes about spontaneously as the global mind paradigm shift changes. And then people take. Well, right now, I know in this audience, there are people, would you stand up, sir, here? This gentleman from the United Nations, who is working in third world countries on the relationship of our interconnectedness and how this paradigm shift is causing a change in the attitudes of agencies like the United Nations, WHO, etc., on very positive changes. Now, what happened in the Berlin Wall? How come all these different groups of people knew that at this precise moment you could have a sudden shift in the whole collective consciousness of that part of the world, part of the global mind shift? There are many paradigms that explore this. So, you know, we have something we call the Maharishi effect, and then there is this whole idea of that you may have read about, the 100th monkey phenomenon, the idea of morphogenetic fields. They're all part of how global mind shifts cause phase transitions in the actuality of what happens in our universe. And I think we're in the midst of it right now. All these events in Europe and Malta and everywhere. Yes?
Can you talk about the receptivity to Murray Gary made in the Eastern Bloc nations and the Soviet Union?
Yes. I've been to the Soviet Union 3 times this year. And Lynn Franklin, sitting here. Lynn, could you raise your hand? She's one of our greatest ambassadors in the Soviet Union from the TM movement. She, in fact, was also Mr. Gorbachev's agent for this country, for Perestroika, that book, Perestroika. And she has been responsible for taking all this literature on transcendental meditation and Maharishi Ayurveda. There, that's how we got introduced to that country. And since then, we've been going there frequently, and now we are opening up Ayurvedic centers throughout the Soviet Union. I mentioned homeopathy in my book, and I also raised some concerns about its efficacy in that it may worsen the symptoms before curing them, etc. Well, I have to tell you that after the book got published, I got a letter from the president of the American Homeopathy Association, and he corrected a lot of my own conceptions about homeopathy. I must profess that I was quite ignorant of some of the basic tenets of homeopathy till he drew them to my attention. And in fact, in my last visit to India, I spoke to Maharishi about homeopathy also. And I now have a completely new interpretation of homeopathy. Homeopathy deals with memories. And what it does is it evokes memory shifts at cellular level by giving you very small doses that re-alter the memory of the cell. And in fact, therefore, can be very effective. Maharishi said, on the material level, probably the most effective. But on the non-material level, those memories in that little bit of matter are really sounds or vibrations in consciousness. So he said, if you could elicit those vibrations in your consciousness, which is some of the techniques that we use with sound, then you could get the same effect. So that's an answer to your question. You're asking me all these controversial questions here. Do I advocate routine childhood immunization? You know, Dr. Jonas Salk, who invented the polio vaccine, is here in New York City today. In fact, he was hoping to come for the seminar and have lunch with us, but he couldn't make it. And I wish he was here when we asked that question. The fact is that some vaccinations have really made an impact. Polio is the most dramatic example. Dr. Salk's invention is the most dramatic example. Polio had completely almost completely disappeared from the face of this earth. And it, you know, for those of us who remember childhood friends with polio, we have a lot to be grateful for some of the vaccination procedures. At the same time, there are many epidemiological studies or large group studies, which show that the incidence of some of the diseases that we attribute to antibiotics and or the introduction of vaccines may not be the result of those procedures. For example, the incidence of tuberculosis went down by about 1,000% before anti-tuberculous drugs came to the scene, or before BCG vaccine was introduced. Similarly, a lot of the other infections, particularly whooping cough, diphtheria, pertussis, whooping cough, there is now epidemiological evidence that, in fact, that these diseases, that we attribute the introduction of vaccines and so on to the disappearance of these diseases. But there is a whole group of social scientists who believe that these so-called infectious diseases disappeared before the widespread use of either vaccination or antibiotics, and they attribute this to two factors. One is improved hygiene, just better cleanliness in general, and two, nutrition, better nutrition. And three, also some natural mutations that spontaneously occur over epochs of time in the microorganisms. So the whole area of immunology and vaccination at the moment has become extremely controversial. There are groups, I'd say 80 to 90% of doctors believe that immunization should be absolutely mandatory. But there's a group of about, I'd say, emerging group of immunologists who question that. So for me to take a position at this moment would be really unsafe, because I don't know what the data is. It will take a little while for the picture to become clear. So I think we should stop for lunch. It's 12:30. Why don't we meet at, how about 2 o'clock? And from 2 to 4, we'll discuss the 5 sensory experiences, how to enliven them more, and then we'll talk about biological aging. To summarize what we did this morning, and I think we established, at least intellectually, a framework where we can see the universe as an expression of consciousness. Consciousness being a universal field, unified field, that breaks up into the process forces of nature that ultimately give us the appearance of physical matter, including that of our human body. We can say consciousness conceives, constructs, governs, and becomes the physical body. Consciousness conceives, constructs, governs, and becomes the physical body. And in the Veda, in the Vedic literature, we find a very elegant description of this process. We find an elegant description of how this whole process takes place. We might even call it the process of morphogenesis and differentiation. Morphogenesis means to give rise to form, and differentiation is to become many. Ultimately, all is one, one is all. But how does the one appear as so many? And are the so many the one? And if so, how come they appear different? And the explanation of morphogenesis and differentiation in Veda is very identical to the understanding of the holographic paradigm. And I think perhaps people in this audience are already familiar with the holographic paradigm. How many people know about holograms? So already a lot of very sophisticated audience here. But nevertheless, I'd like to go over some of the principles of holography because they very closely match the Vedic description of morphogenesis and differentiation. A hologram is a three-dimensional image of an object. If you've been to Disney World, then you'll see many holograms over there. See Michael Jackson coming at you and he looks like he's for real till you come close enough and then you realize that in fact it's an apparition but not the original person. So holograms are these three-dimensional light figures that are made from laser techniques. And the way you make a hologram is, let's say you wanted to make a hologram of me. What you do is you take a laser beam and you put it through a beam splitter, an instrument that's called a beam splitter because it splits the laser beam into two beams. And what's a laser beam? It's just a frequency of light, just one frequency of light. So you take a laser beam, put it through this instrument, which is called a beam splitter. It splits the original beam into two beams. One is called the object beam, and the other is called the reference beam. The object beam is the beam that comes at the object, in this case, me. And the reference beam actually bounces off a mirror and again comes towards the object. And the two, after hitting the object, create what is called an interference pattern. This object beam comes, it let's say hits me, the object, it scatters into many, and then the reference beam also bounces off the object and then it scatters also. And now you have an interference pattern. And you can record it on a photographic plate. And if you look at that now, that photographic plate which has this interference pattern, all you'll see is some squiggles. Some wavy lines here and there. But now you take that and you put a laser beam through it, and especially the laser beam at the original angle at which the original person was shot at, those angles, if you put a laser beam through it, you'll see out there in space a three-dimensional projection of the original person. And it will be completely lifelike. You can walk around it, etc. What is interesting about the hologram is that if you take that interference pattern and you cut it into a million pieces, or let's say a billion pieces, you cut it into the smallest bits conceivable and you put a laser beam through it, you'll still get the whole object. You won't get just, let's say you took a little bit of it and you thought that was my fingernail or my hair follicle or something. Put a little laser beam through it and you won't get a fingernail or a hair follicle. You'll get the whole person again. That's why it's called a hologram. The whole is contained in every part. In fact, you cannot destroy a hologram. It's immortal. Once it's made, you can't get rid of it. The picture becomes fuzzier. The smaller you get, it becomes fuzzy. So it won't be that clear. We may say that in the bit, the whole is contained, but the memory is not so clear. In the bit, the whole is contained, but the memory is a little fuzzy. So the picture that you get is a little fuzzy. But it's the whole picture. This is the popular Vedic expression. Maharshi uses it frequently also. He says, in fact, he made this expression very famous in the RTM movement, every grain of sap contains the full tree. Every grain of sap contains the full tree. And you've heard that famous poem by William Blake, is it? in every, what, I don't remember the poem now. To see the world in a grain of sand, yes. And what else? Hold infinity in the palm of your hand. So that's the holographic paradigm. Thank you. Thank you. That's the hologram. William Blake is talking about holography. And he's talking about how the whole universe is in fact contained in every part. This is also the Ayurvedic view of the human body. This body contains the whole universe. Not only does this body contain the whole universe, every cell in the body contains the whole universe. All the information that is there in the universe is coded in every cell of the body. And if you access the information in your own body, you can eavesdrop literally on the whole universe. Because there's no need to go for second-hand knowledge. First-hand knowledge is there right here. In every bit of our body is contained all the information, includes all the evolutionary history of species and everything. All the information is encoded in every cell. There's a Vedic sutra for this also. Say in Indra's, I won't use the Sanskrit, so just in English I'll translate it. In Indra's heaven, there is a set of pearls. And you pick up one pearl and you'll see all the other pearls in it. And then the sutra goes on to say, not only will you see all the other pearls in it, all the other pearls are contained in this one pearl. And you can pick any one of them, and all the other pearls are there. And this whole principle is described in Vedic literature in the form of mandalas. Mandalas are these patterns that are literally holograms. That are literally holograms, and let me show you the mandala on which Ayurveda is based. And it is, comes to us from a tradition called Sankhya. Let me just show you. This is one of the mandalas. I've actually westernized it a little bit. But basically, this is the scheme of morphogenesis and differentiation in Ayurveda. I'll put this other one perhaps as a little more more explanatory. The ultimate ground of being is called Purusha. That's the technical word in Sanskrit. Purusha literally means witness, the silent witness. Now all of you, for example, are aware of that silent witness in yourself. It's that non-changing part of you. When you were a little child, it was there. When you were an adolescent, it was there. You grow up and mature into an adult, it's there. When you're old, it's there. It doesn't seem to age. It's not your feelings or emotions. It's the background of your emotions. It's there. It's watching the whole show. It watched the childhood come and go. It watched the adolescence come and go, etc. That non-changing silent witness that is at the back of all this. That's Purusha. It's also called pure consciousness. It's in transcendental meditation when we experience no thought content, just complete silence, the gap between thoughts, that's Purusha, it's the witness. It's not thought, it's between the thoughts. So that is pure consciousness. And there are many other things you can say about it. It's unmanifested, formless, passive, beyond attributes, beyond cause and effect, beyond space and time, pure existence, life, intelligence, whatever, pure knowledge, bliss, the unified field, etc. Then it interacts with its own self and it transforms itself. That field becomes the probability amplitude, we can say. It transforms itself into impulses of intelligence. It begins to take direction. And in the Vedic scheme, Purusha is always the background. And then when it begins to take direction, that's called Prakriti. Also, many times symbolized as Shiva and Shakti. Shiva is beyond attributes, but Shakti is the energy, it's the female energy. That's why the female energy is the creative energy, always. It's the most important force of creation in the universe. And this is now actually the impulses of intelligence emerging from that field of all possibilities. We say pure consciousness beginning to take direction, pure intelligence becoming intelligent, consciousness becoming conscious, emergence of impulses of intelligence from pure consciousness, streams of thought emerging from the ocean of consciousness. Maharshi calls the ocean of consciousness Rishi, which also means seer. And then he says as Rishi becomes aware of itself, then we have Devata. Now in India, Devata is often confused with gods, etc. But not in the Vedic scheme. Devata is this now impulses of intelligence, the process in that field. And then Chandas is form. So Rishi is pure consciousness, spirit, unmanifested, interacts with its own self, becomes mind, streams of thought, Devata, and then mind becomes matter, Chandas. So that's how that transformation takes place. And that gives rise to the intellect as well. What is the intellect? The intellect is the property of discrimination. So suddenly a three-in-one has emerged in rudimentary form. The seer has become aware of whom? Of himself. But in the process of becoming aware of himself, he now has created the artifact of three out of one. There's an observer, which is the seer, a process of observation, which is also the seer, and that which is observed, which is also the seer. But now this intellectual idea has come about that there are three. So you have one manifesting into three. And then from there it proceeds. That intellect becomes the ego, the sense of I am. We start separating ourselves from each other. Because, you know, there's an observer, there's an observed, there's a process of observation. And this creates the whole artifact of perception where we feel separate from each other as a result of the ego, which is a construct of the intellect. And in Ayurveda we say this is a big mistake, and there's a technical word for it, pragyaparad, which means the mistake of the intellect. If you translate it, it says the mistake of the intellect. And what's the mistake of the intellect? Well, it creates this very artificial distinction that, you know, I am separate from you and we are all separate, whereas in fact we are all like that grain of sand which encodes the whole universe. And that ego is called ahankar, and then that differentiates into the organic universe through sattva, which is a principle, psychophysiological principles, and through tamas into Chandas, which is the inorganic universe. And then there's a process of experiencing. So now we have on one side what we call the whole organic universe with senses, organs of action, mind, and you have on the other side sound, texture, form, objects of taste and smell, the essence of which is space, air, light, water, earth. Symbolic expressions of impulses of intelligence. But in fact, this is all artifactual. It's all as a result of bits of sensory experience. And with bits of sensory experience, you can't comprehend the whole. So we see these distinctions. In fact, the observer, the observed, and the process of observation are one entity. And the technical word is Sanghita. It means collectedness of all of them. They are one entity. They separate themselves to have this big cosmic play that we are all a part of. And we just forget the whole origin of it. And that's part of the fun of the play. You have to first hide yourself to seek yourself. So it's just a big cosmic drama that we are all taking part in, and it goes on forever and ever. We keep hiding ourselves and we keep seeking ourselves. And that's why we shouldn't take it too seriously. So that's the holographic scheme. But coming back now to the idea that every bit, in fact, encodes everything else. So in order to access this, all we need to do is have the process of attention, the value of attention. And if the expression is, whatever we put our attention on will become stronger as an experience. And we will create through the process of attention. That's number one. And the second principle here is that form precedes matter, and what precedes form is intelligence or intention, and what precedes that is consciousness. So consciousness, intention, function, matter. Let's take that principle and see if we can apply it to some of our sensory experiences. We'll start maybe with sight. And we'll go through all the five senses briefly, and then in the latter part of today we'll do the whole area of biological aging. But let's go over some very simple techniques that are taught in Ayurveda to improve sight. Now let me warn you, if you wear glasses, you should be prepared to, if you do them regularly, you should be prepared to throw them away. But in the meanwhile, you should at least once a month see an optometrist and get a change in lenses. And that can become expensive because you're changing your lenses quite frequently. Also, if you have normal vision, you might become quite extraordinary with your vision. But in Ayurveda, we say that's normal. And we shouldn't confuse the normal with the psychopathology of the average. The average is so dull and so pervasive that we don't even notice it. We call it normal. So that's also, if you're wearing glasses, I would advise that you do these exercises in whichever way is comfortable with you, for you. Either wearing the glasses or not wearing the glasses. Decide what's comfortable. But then do them every day in the same way. If you start doing them without glasses, then every day do them without glasses. If you do them with glasses, some of them you have to do without glasses, but if you do them with glasses, then do them with glasses every day. Also, if you wear lenses, contact lenses, then don't do the exercise while wearing contact lenses because you can potentially injure the eyes. Okay, so we'll start with these six or seven little procedures that are mentioned in Vedic texts as improving vision and developing quite extraordinary abilities of seeing. The first one is called looking towards the sun with the eyes closed. And basically that's all you do. You close the eyes and you look towards the sun with the eyes closed for about 30 seconds or so. The idea is that we are part of a biological organism. The seer and the seen are part of that entity. We have eyes because there's light, and light exists because there are eyes to see. And of course, light is what stimulates the cells of the retina. Of course, we make sure that the eyes are closed, otherwise you'll harm the eyes. So 30 seconds. If you don't have access to sunlight, you could also use what is called full spectrum light, which is now available in most places. In fact, there's a big company in New Jersey called Vitalight that makes full spectrum light. And I would recommend that in your house also you have full spectrum light. There are many studies that are coming out from all over the world, and particularly from England, where they show that in classrooms, in children, if you just replace ordinary lights with full spectrum light, which mirrors sunlight, the performance of the students goes up. Their concentration ability goes up. Their memory increases. Their attention span changes. And even, most remarkably, a study published in The Lancet, in the English journal Lancet, shows that the number of children, frequency of colds and winter sickness decreases just by using full spectrum light. It's amazing. because after all, you know, it replicates nature's light. And there are many studies that show not only that our eye cells respond to full spectrum light, but even our skin responds to full spectrum light. So full spectrum light is healing light. Also, you heard of seasonal affective disorder, SAD syndrome. I'm sure some of you are familiar with that, where people get quite depressed. And usually they get depressed in winter times when light is less. And this depression can be quite serious sometimes. It can even lead to psychosis and suicide. In the past, people used to treat this with psychotropic agents. But now we know that if you just expose these people to full spectrum light, the depression clears away completely. Also, jet lag is an experience that can be minimized with full spectrum light. So if you experience jet lag and you just sit for a little while and under full spectrum light, this study was published in the New England Journal of Medicine recently. Performed at Harvard Medical School. And the reason that is because full spectrum light replicates natural light. Anyway, going back to the exercise, looking towards the sun with the eyes closed for about 30 seconds is followed by a procedure known as watching the colors. And here what you do is you continue to look towards the sun with the eyes closed, and then you gently massage the eyes, both the eyes, with the eyes closed, with both hands, while you're still looking towards the sun. Do that for about 30 seconds or so. Then you take your hands away, and you will experience in your consciousness colors. You'll break up that light into 7 colors. In Ayurveda, we have different body types, Vata, Pitta, Kapha, and actually 7 different combinations. And different people experience different ranges of colors. Pitta body types will see more red, Kapha body types will see more blue, Vata body types may see more violet, etc. Doesn't matter. You'll see a range of colors, and then once in a while you'll just see one intense color in consciousness. The eyes are still closed, you're still looking towards the sun. You'll see, and you should then focus on that light. Just have your attention on that light. And you can hold it, try and hold it for as long as it can. It's like a little candle flame or something. Hold that in your awareness. You're experiencing light and consciousness. And this will ultimately translate into heightened awareness of colors afterwards. Now, in nowhere in the Ayurvedic scheme of things do we try to manipulate our experience, our sensory experience, inactivity. So we don't go around saying, oh, I'm looking at all these vibrant colors and they look so beautiful, etc. That's mood making. What we do is we do the exercise and then we forget about it completely. But we will notice that colors will become more alive in our awareness. That we will experience more shades of color. There'll be life to objects in our environment, and the colors will be much more vibrant. And then the third procedure is called staring at the moon, if it's there, without blinking. And this light of the moon, which is also sunlight bouncing off the moon, has a different effect on the retina. It has a calming effect. It has a cooling effect, especially for those who are Pitta body types. Pitta body types are hot-tempered, angry, impatient, and under stress. This cooling moonlight has an effect in their psychophysiology. So these three procedures are for stimulating the cells of the retina. These are followed by a number of procedures which are for increasing not only the strength of the extraocular muscles, but also for accessing information from the brain, for accessing certain types of sensory recall, and I'll go over these now. They're all either variations of what is called the Indian dance movement, or they are also mudras. Mudras is the technical word for fixed positions of the eyes. So if you've seen somebody doing an Indian dance, you'll see that they move their eyes in all directions without moving their head. And like this, all these directions. And these exercises, we can show you some. You have these, by the way, in your handouts, some of these charts. In English, we can say tracking exercises. You take one of these charts, you have them in your handouts. You put it about an arm's length in front of you, preferably on a wall. Then you stand in front of the wall and you watch the tracks at random for about 15, 20 seconds. So you go around on these tracks in any random way you want. There are a couple of other tracking exercises. These are all tracking. You follow the dots randomly, go around the circle, etc. Yeah, so these are all tracking exercises. About an arm's length in front of you on the wall. Stay in the center and just follow the tracks. And then after tracking, you do an exercise which is based on a mudra, which I'll come to in a moment, the mudras. But the exercise is called converging. You have this chart also in your handout. Converging. C-O-N-V-E-R-G-I-N-G. Converging. You take this sheet of paper which has this diagram. You hold it about this far and you stare in the middle here and you have the intention of moving that face into the head. Try it out now. See, and then bring it closer if you can't do it till you bring it to some point where you can in fact put the face in the head. Now what happens with this particular exercise is very intriguing actually. If you put brainwaves, if you do brainwave tests on somebody who's doing this, they'll begin to show what is called increased brainwave coherence. Now, increased brainwave coherence is something that occurs even quite dramatically in meditation, in transcendental meditation. The brainwave coherence goes up. What is brainwave coherence? Brainwave coherence, I'll give you the technical definition, then I'll explain it in English also, is defined as the constancy of relationship between different brain waves at a specified frequency when measured from different parts of the scalp. What it means is that when you put electrodes over the brain in different parts, you'll find that different parts of the brain, you can pick up the same frequency many times, alpha waves or beta waves or whatever. But they do not have a constancy of relationship to each other. It's like going to the symphony before the performance. Let's say you go to the symphony and it's a 100-piece orchestra. All the musicians know exactly the right tunes, the right frequencies. They know exactly what to do. But they're all practicing on their own. They don't have any relationship to each other. So what you'll hear is noise. You won't hear music. But then the conductor comes along and he starts establishing a relationship. They're still playing the same frequencies, still playing the same tunes, still playing the same instrument, but because of this relationship that the conductor has established, you convert the noise into music. Music is the constancy of relationship between these different frequencies.
This is the end.
Similarly, in our consciousness, most of the time, there are infinite number of internal dialogues going on. I have to pay my mortgage, you know, when will I get to work, etc. Millions of things going on all at the same time. And these internal dialogues create a lot of background noise. And what happens is, when you establish brainwave coherence, then these different frequencies begin to establish a constancy of relationship which you can pick up on an EEG machine. And I said that in fact during meditation, particularly when people transcend, then they have a very marked degree of brainwave coherence. And in people who have higher states of consciousness, in Ayurveda there are 7 states of consciousness that we define, which I'm not going to get into in detail today because there won't be this artifact of sensory experience for time. But there's waking state of consciousness, there's dream state of consciousness, sleep state of consciousness. These all have their distinct physiology. And there's transcendental consciousness, which is the 4th state of consciousness. Then when transcendental, which is also called Surya. And then there is cosmic consciousness, when transcendental consciousness is now there all the time. That silent witness is there even in activity, more dominant in our awareness. So even though we are in the midst of chaos and confusion, that inner silence is not disturbed. That is called cosmic consciousness, there all the time. It's even in dream state. You're experiencing the dream, there's a silent witness watching the dream, etc. That's called cosmic consciousness. And then there's refined cosmic consciousness. Maharishi originally called it God consciousness, but then Americans told him that wasn't a safe word to use, so he changed the language to refined cosmic consciousness. And that's the sixth state of consciousness. And then unity. In that, what happens is, you begin in the objects of perception to see that transcendent, that field of silence, yourself. And then beyond that is unity consciousness, where there's no distinction between observer, process of observation, and that observed. You are one with everything else. Each of these states is said to have different access to knowledge and different access to information, and also to have its own distinct physiology. The expression is knowledge is structured in consciousness, and also your physiology changes with different states of consciousness. Now we have early evidence from long-term meditators, people who have been doing it for many, many years, that in fact their brain waves, even in activity, are the same as of someone else who would be in deep meditation. So they're in activity, very clear, etc. But their brain waves show this distinct physiology. Anyway, leaving that aside, even a simple procedure like this increases this brainwave coherence. And this adaptation was by an ophthalmologist, originally a Johns Hopkins, who found that if you had children do it, children like to do these games, you know, they like to put the face into the head, etc., their brainwave coherence goes up. And he found that it was very useful in treating learning disabilities. Also, in increasing attention span. Also, in retrieval of memory. See, memory, everybody has the memory of the whole universe in them anywhere. It's there. It's encoded, holographically encoded in every bit of your body. What is the difference between somebody has good memory and bad memory? Just the retrieval. The filing cabinets are all there, the information is all there. Only those messengers who go and look for the files sort of are distracted. So when you have brainwave coherence, then retrieval of memory becomes very strong. And I would, if there are any people who treat children with learning disabilities, and people especially hyperactive children, or if you just want to increase their attention span and memory, just this simple exercise will make a big difference. And you can actually record it. You can see what happens to brainwave coherence when they do it. These exercises are all based on mudras. Mudras are specific positions of the eyes that are used in Ayurveda. So we can put that away. The next procedure is a mudra. And the mudra is just staring at the tip of your nose. So you just stare at the tip of your nose without blinking the eyes for about 30 seconds or so. And it will also elicit this response of increased brainwave coherence. It will also elicit this brainwave response. Then the next mudra is called opening the third eye. Technically, that's what it's called. But it means looking or staring at this point between the eyebrows here. Doesn't look very pleasant. Right back. The eyes point here. Again, for as long as it's comfortable. 30 seconds. It increases brainwave coherence. Now, I'm sure some of you here, it's a very eclectic audience here, so I'm sure a lot of people have heard of NLP. How many people are familiar with, oh my God, So, neuro-linguistic programming. Now, first of all, I don't like the idea of programming, but that besides that, the people in NLP have hit upon something quite interesting. And what we find is that if you look at the Vedic texts, you find all these procedures that the NLP people are talking about, but much more sophisticated, much more refined. And these eye mudras are actually, eye movements are a function of what is happening in consciousness. When somebody is looking down and to the left, usually they are recalling an auditory memory, something that they heard. They're having a conversation with themselves. When people look down and to the right, they are like this. They are usually recalling an emotional experience. When people look up and to the right, they usually, that happens very infrequently, that they're usually creating a new image. Creative artists. Creating a new image. Synthesizing a new image in consciousness. Now, in fact, if you observe each other in conversation, you'll see people move their eyes in response to what they're saying, and you can see what they're doing. They're either recalling an image or some conversation they heard, etc. Very often, if you replicate what they're doing, you will have, the consciousness is a field, you will experience what they're thinking. Now, this can become manipulative, and therefore, remember one thing. Anytime you begin to manipulate, it always comes back. That's the law of nature. So never use any technique to manipulate. Never. But it is true that since consciousness is a field, and eye movements reflect what is going on in consciousness, that if you're sitting with somebody and you just replicate their eye movements, you will know what field of information they're accessing. There are some good descriptions of this, very good descriptions of this. Exactly, you might even see the same image that they're experiencing. In any case, the mudras will strengthen your ability to recall. So if you practice this mudra and stand with the eyes open, looking up and to the left and holding the eyeballs there like that, that will strengthen your ability to recall images, to retrieve images from anywhere in the past. Memory, recall. Now that doesn't mean we look up to the left and try and imagine something we're trying to recall. No. We just practice the procedure, then we forget about it. So, again, we don't manipulate our experience. So you look up to the left, hold it for 30 seconds, that's done. That mudra is done. And the effect is later that you will know, that you will notice that your recall of images is very good. Similarly, yes? No, the question, thanks for asking that. Is this the same for right and left-handed people? No. What I'm saying applies to right-handed people. It's the opposite for left-handed people. So it's the opposite for left-handed people. Sometimes people are ambidextrous also, so it can be confusing. You'll have to find out which is... In any case, it doesn't matter. You're going to do all the mudras anyway. Right? So it doesn't matter. So look up and to the left, 30 seconds. Look down and to the left, 30 seconds. That's auditory recall. Look down and to the right, that's emotional recall. Look up to the right, that's the ability to create new images. Nose, it strengthens the ability to recall smells. But smells, in any case, are never forgotten. And therefore, one doesn't have to worry about it, except for those people who've had accidents and have lost or have dulled sensory perception to smell and taste. There we recommend that they do this track, this, and also just intend or have the idea that you're looking at your tongue. Just have the idea that you're looking at your tongue. That will heighten recall of and also enliven the experience of taste and the memory of taste. And we'll come to taste a little while later also. So, and this opening up the third eye is also supposed to increase intuition according to the Vedic text. All we know is that it definitely increases all the things I told you. Memory, attention span, brainwave coherence. I will see about intuition. We'll have to study people. What is intuition? It's just heightened state of awareness. A person who is intuitive is more aware, that's all. He has access to information because of increased awareness. So, in fact, past, present, and future are all contained in one continuum of infinite possibilities. So if you have heightened states of awareness, then to intuit something in the future is not really anything extraordinary. It's just putting attention on one possibility out of that, in that field of infinite correlation. So these different eye movements, mudras basically, which we hold for 15, 20, 30 seconds at the most for as long as is comfortable. Nose, here, tongue, there. Any questions on this? Do it with the eyes open. Okay, the next set of exercises strengthens the lens of the eye. Lens and gives flexibility to the lens. There are three procedures here. One is called focusing, which is very simple. Look at something near and then look at something far. Look at something near, look at something far. Look at something near, look at something far. Okay, so traditionally this was, you looked at your hand and then you looked at the horizon. That may be difficult in Manhattan, but look at something in the distance. And you do that for about 30 seconds. This increases the flexibility of the lens, which as people grow older gets rigid and then the fluid begins to stagnate, ultimately gives rise to cataracts, etc. So you increase the pliability of the lens by doing this procedure. Just as an aside, I should tell you, I go to Maharishi Nagar every 6 weeks. I meet some very old people there in their 90s and late 90s. Centenarians, they don't wear glasses. They can hear you whisper at the end of the room. You have to be very careful what you say. And it's very extraordinary. They don't have a single cavity. They have all their original teeth. They have very good sensory perception. And, you know, that is what normal should be. That is what normal should be. So, No. You just look and then look back and forth for 30 seconds. Okay, the next exercise is called distant reading. And here what you do is you take some printed material, preferably reinterpretation of the body or something like that, and you stick it up on your wall about an arm's length like this. And then you read it from there if it's comfortable. If it's not, then you can read it from wherever it's comfortable. And then every day you move back a little bit. The journey of 1,000 miles begins with the first step.
What size print?
The print I gave you, the reinterpretation of the body. About an arm's length, yes? No, move away from it. Just a little bit. Every day. I suggest don't do it with contact lenses because, you know, you're causing a lot of changes, physiological changes, and you could conceivably injure the eye. Glasses, you can do it with glasses. If you do it with glasses, then do it every day with glasses. If you do it without glasses, then do it every day without glasses. And if you do wear glasses, then see an optometrist for change in lens at least once every 6 weeks or even once every month. My two colleague doctors, Rosenberg and Auerbach, used to wear glasses for 25 years and don't wear them anymore. And also, for those of you who've heard of Meyer Schneider, how many people here know of Meyer Schneider? Some people know here. Meyer Schneider is an extraordinary man who was born blind with no light perception, congenital glaucoma, congenital cataract. When he was 6 years old, he chanced upon some of these exercises, not all. In fact, today I'm giving you many more than he knew about. And he practiced them since the age of 6 years. This man had no light perception, zero. Born blind with congenital cataract in the Soviet Union, emigrated to Israel around the age of 6 or 7. I did a television show with him recently. He drove his own car, and he doesn't wear glasses. And he's written this extraordinary book called My Life and My Vision. I recommend that book not because of the exercises he gives you, because some of them are not the real ones, at least from the Vedic perspective, but the book is very inspiring. This man had no premature cognitive commitments. He refused to believe that he wouldn't see. And he just did it. And now he has a big institute in San Francisco for the blind, and people come from all over the world to his clinic. If you are going to change your vision, then if you don't change the glasses, you're going to go back. You see, because every time you wear the glasses, you do go back a little bit. So one has to, otherwise it's not. Maybe you can trade them in. People are going to ask specific questions like macular degeneration, retinitis pigmentosa. There's so many things. I would say that don't have any premature cognitive commitment. Just do the exercises and see what happens, even with macular degeneration. I know, in fact, that with macular degeneration, the first few exercises, looking at the sun, watching the colors, helps. I know that it helps even with retinitis pigmentosa. The only contradiction, if any, is active bleeding in the eyes, as occurs in diabetic retinopathy sometimes. That's only contraindication, because you could theoretically increase the bleeding by these procedures. So otherwise, any disease. So the question was, we don't make any premature commitments, and then I go on to say that possibly you shouldn't theoretically use it in diabetic retinopathy, and I have to say that actually, because in diabetic retinopathy there's many times active bleeding going on, and you should wait till that is subsided before, you know, you do any procedure. Same with contact lenses. You don't want to injure the eyes because it's in that position. Okay, where were we? Focusing and then distant reading. So you step back every day, just a little bit, till you can see that printed material from the end of the room. And then you start with a bigger room like this one. And do it. And then ultimately, it is said you should read from the horizon. They say anything less than that is a premature commitment. The opposite of distant... by the way, I've been doing this distant reading, interestingly enough. What I do is I get onto airplanes. I do a lot of traveling. I read the small printed materials on the front of the plane. I've been doing it maybe a year or so. And now I can read from the back of the plane all the little things that are written in the front of the plane, which is not bad. The opposite of that is close reading. So you start again from here, and you bring it closer, closer, closer every day, till you can read it even if it's against your nose. So your range of vision is from smaller, closer than the closest, to farther than the farthest. In offices where you work with computers, yes, actually when the converging exercise and these mudras are very good for that. Because computers, people then start getting distracted and headaches and this and this. The converging exercise, the mudras that we talked about, these various positions are very good for that. So these three exercises or procedures increase the pliability or flexibility of the lens, which gets, as people grow older, it gets rigid, etc. And the next one, which you might find a little distasteful, literally, is washing the eyes with your saliva. What you do is, you first make sure that your mouth is clean, brush your teeth, etc. Then take a glass of water. Rinse it in the mouth. Rinse your mouth with the water, having made sure that you brushed your teeth and all that. And you try and elicit some copious salivary secretions. Maybe you can imagine the taste of a lemon or something. That will bring out some secretions. And then you take that and you take it out in an eye cup if you want. In India they just slash the eyes with that. And then slash the eyes. But we can be, if you want, a little more sophisticated about it. Put it in an eye cup and then wash the eyes with that. Then do the same thing with the other procedure. When I was first told about this exercise by a vaidya in India, he told me, he said, with this procedure you'll be able to reverse cataracts. I said, come on. But he said, no, I have lots of patients and try it out. The logic, of course, is that your salivary enzymes are proteolytic enzymes. And proteolytic enzymes are digest protein. That's what they are. Your salivary enzymes can digest a medium rare steak or even a rare steak. But it only digests dead protein. Otherwise, you'll be digesting your mucous membrane in your stomach all the time, which you don't. These proteolytic enzymes digest dead protein always. And that's what cataracts are. That's what corneal opacities are also. These enzymes, the membranes of the eyes, are permeable to these enzymes. And in fact, to me it was enough that if we could prevent cataracts, would be great. But now we have about 10 documented cases. We're launching into a full-scale study, in fact, on reversal of cataracts, because we have ophthalmologically certified 10 cases. This person had cataracts and doesn't have them anymore. Okay, so this procedure is also extremely useful. People have come up to me and told me that, and perhaps you know of this, that there's a reference to this in the New Testament about how spit was used to bring back vision. Is it true?
Yes.
There you are. So the traditions are quite similar everywhere. That's how Jesus healed, right?
Right.
The blind. Great. So we have a good reference for that one. Now, in the Vedic literature, sound is the most important aspect of healing. More than anything else, sound is the most primordial sensory input. And when we hear a thought in the Vedic literature, you say, we don't say, I had a thought, you say, I heard a thought. Because a thought is a vibration in consciousness. And there is a technical word for this, it's called Shruti. And in fact, the rishis said they heard the sound of nature and they heard the music of nature in meditation. And they realized that it was sound that gave rise to form. When we have thoughts, we are hearing sounds. And then these sounds, we of course experience in a language which we've been trained in, English or whatever. But if you look at the root words of all the languages, you'll find they have similar sounds. Mother, mater, mom, mata, ma, etc. All, actually, all the different languages, the root words have similar sounds. Then they change according to the culture, language, etc. In fact, once I was talking to Maharshi about this, and I was quoting to him, I said, Maharshi, in the Bible, there's this expression, and first there was the Word, and then the Word was made into flesh. And he thought for a moment, and he said, are you sure they didn't say it was the sound? because the word is actually the sound. At the primordial level, it's the sound that becomes the word. You hear it. You say, I had a thought, but you heard it. And then that translates into, you say, I had this thought and I felt this emotion. It also becomes sensation afterwards. Then it structures the entire perceptual experience. When you see something, what you're doing is you're touching the light that's bouncing off that object. When you taste something, you're touching the taste, sweet, sour, salt, whatever. When you smell something, you're also touching it. And touch, sensation also comes from sound. But sound transforms into touch, which transforms into all the other perceptual experiences. So this was the theory. And recently, there's been some very elegant work in American universities on the effects of sound and music particularly on physiology. For example, we know now that music directly influences things like heart rate, brain waves, blood pressure, stomach contractions, levels of hormones, beta endorphins, immune levels, etc. Why do people listen to music? It makes them feel good. And why does it make them feel good? Because it has all these physiological effects. Now it turns out that the kind of music you listen to also has very distinct physiological effects. You listen to hard rock and all your cells begin to jiggle, literally. If you listen to Beethoven's Funeral March, your lymphocytes get quite depressed, literally. It's been shown. If you experience joyful music, then every cell has that experience also. So music definitely gives rise to form. And the way it gives rise to form, and sound gives rise to form, is through this process of consciousness, in fact, transforms itself into matter through sound. Now, it's also interesting that in Ayurveda we use the word Gandharva for music. Gandharva were the devatas or the gods of not only music but also of healing. In Greek medicine, Apollo is the god of music, but Apollo is also the god of medicine. You see the similarities all over. There are many sounds that are called primordial sounds, and these sounds are part of the healing tradition of Ayurveda, and these primordial sounds we use in consciousness only. And the usual technique is, and this I can't teach you in a group, it has to be done on a one-to-one basis, and it's preferred that you have the experience of meditation also. So you're in that, you first settle down the mind in quiet stillness, complete stillness, and then you just have one sound emerging from there, through intention. You evoke the sound silently in your consciousness. And because sound translates into form, that then becomes a physiological effect. A lot of the techniques in Vedic tradition are based on this primordial. It's like throwing a little coin in a still pond. You'll see the ripple and you'll see the effect. But if it's not a still pond, it's a turbulent ocean, then you could throw the Empire State Building and wouldn't make a bit of a difference. But if it's a still pond, then it's just a little pebble. And the size of the pebble, the shape of the pebble will make a difference. And what these primordial sounds are, they are really healing mantras. There's a lot of misunderstanding in the West about mantras. There are textbooks, entire libraries that are devoted to these mantras. There are transcending mantras, healing mantras, etc. The word mantra comes from two roots. Man, which means mind. Tra is the root word for instrument. Mantra means instrument of the mind, instrument for thought. And there are these very, very distinct sounds that can be used for healing that are called primordial sounds. One sound that everybody is familiar with, anybody who's had even a basic inkling of the East, is the sound of Om, for example. So I'm not recommending that we use that sound. I'm just giving you an example, because in fact I recommend that you not use that sound unless you want to become a monk. But because that's the basic vibration of that sound. So we don't use that sound. But I'm just giving you an example. Om is one of the primordial sounds. And when you use that sound in the following manner, for example, Om, and you do it in front of a gel, every time you use that sound, you'll have a particular mandala appear in a gel. You can see the emergence of form. This is a very distinct mandala. It's called Sri Yantra. Every time you use that sound, you'll get this mandala. And it's true for all the different mantras. Each of them transforms itself into a particular hologram of information. Each of them transforms itself into a particular hologram of information which gives rise to form. So there's something very powerful here for healing. Now let's go over a few sounds together that are also holistic sounds, but which we can practice together, not ones that we do not have, that will have a holistic effect on just about everybody. So the first sound is the sound of, it's the humming sound, and this is how it's done. It's a pranayama. I'll do it first and we can practice it together also. Take a deep breath, and then as you exhale, but with the mouth closed, you make this sound. I'll make it now. Every cell will vibrate with that sound. Just let's do it together. See, the effect of that sound is very powerful on individual physiology. Take a deep breath and then through the nose exhale it and make that sound as you. This is the effect of that particular vibration, and this is a holistic sound that you, and it's also a pranayama. Pranayama means a breathing technique, because what you do is you take that deep breath and then you use it only on the exhalation, and you prolong the exhalation for as long as you can. Let's try it once again, prolonging the exhalation for as long as you can. Okay, that's good. If you had a few thousand people doing that, you'd bring down the roof. Really. That's why when marchers go, they say, don't step at the same time, you know. They break up the march because you can collapse a bridge by doing that. Sound can shatter objects, and because it becomes form. This particular sound is a healing sound. It's called the hum sound, hum of creation. Sorry? That vibration transforms itself into a pattern. And ultimately, what's a neuropeptide? It's a molecule structured out of a pattern, out of a thought. What's a thought in its most fundamental state? Sound. Well, I'm just giving you the sounds that are mentioned as healing sounds in the Vedic texts. And we're only beginning to do some studies now. There is one scientist in England who is studying the effects of sounds on cancer cells. It's very interesting, actually. I'm glad you asked the question. He can expose these cancer cells in a test tube to certain sounds, primordial sounds. And he finds that the cancer cells blow up. When he exposes normal cells to the same sound, they become lively. Because the whole of creation is a sound, actually. It's different vibrations. fundamental level. Okay, let's proceed to some other sounds. I have a list of these, and we won't go through all of them. Let's take the second one here. You know Dr. Norman Cousins and all his work on laughter? Okay, I mentioned that work to the Ayurvedic doctors. Okay, those people who don't have these handouts, we can give them out. Just leave them and they can pick them up, or you want to give them now, whatever. Later. Let's do it a little later. So, where was I? I was talking about Dr. Norman Cousins. You know the whole story of Norman Cousins, right? Most of you know it anyway. He was very sick and he was here in New York and dying of ankylosing spondylitis, heart failure, etc., etc. And then at that time he was, editor of the Saturday Review, is it? And one day he heard his doctors talking about the fact that he was dying. And he panicked. He heard the doctors talking about his impending death. So he checked himself out, went to a hotel somewhere here in Manhattan, and bought all the videos of Candid Camera and Groucho Marx and Laurel and Hardy and Charlie Chaplin, because being a man of literature, he believed that laughter is the best medicine, literally.